Okay, you're probably wondering, this isn't Radiolab. Well, it's not, but it kind of is. I'm Roddy Nickpour, and Maine Public is bringing you a special evening with Robert Krulwich, speaking at the Gracie Theater in Bangor last month, headlining the 4th Annual Maine Science Festival, which is a celebration of science in Maine for all ages. Robert's going to talk with us about math and chemistry and why it all seems really scary, because it's just numbers and gibberish. But he's going to bring in metaphors and pictures and their role in helping him make sense of the world. So now we'll turn to Maine Public CEO Mark Vogelzang to bring Robert on stage.
Hi, everybody. The introduction, being introduced as the introducer, is always a sort of a solid place to be. We're delighted to have Robert here tonight. He really doesn't need an introduction for you. He's on your radio every Saturday, and one of the nights, Robert, we put you on real late at night. And as all of you know, the public radio stations across the country, Radiolab is the most important program that's out there, because it has replaced, I think, Car Talk as the big deal. Don't tell that to Peter Sagal. And wait, don't tell me. I'm not going to go into your background, because we're going to have a little time to talk afterwards. We'll talk some about your background, Robert. But let's welcome him to the stage and here to Maine.
I don't know about you. I don't know if I'm slow or just a teeny bit off, but things make more sense to me when I can see a picture in my head. Pictures talk to me, make me feel more in control. Without a picture, I confess, I sometimes get a little bit mentally lost. So what I want to talk to you about this evening is how, when I'm thinking about a complicated idea, how I put pictures into my own head, and then by extension, how we at Radiolab put pictures into your heads. Because pictures, or metaphors actually, can be tricky, and they can be subtle, and sometimes they can be totally wrong. But when you get the picture right up here, that can be an extraordinarily powerful way to explore the world. So let's just talk for a second about pictures. I remember once having breakfast with my boss at CBS, where I was for a while, a guy named Larry Tisch, who made his fortune in real estate and the stock market, and he invited me to this sort of, it's like a secret kind of breakfast place in New York in those days, where really masters of the universe would circulate between tables, and they would say what seemed to be ordinary things like, "Hi, how you doing, Gary? Hi, nice to see you." But secret things were being said, and something about the handshakes all seemed like kind of special. I was trying to decode it. It was fun. And he brought a friend, another financial guy named T. Boone Pickens, with him on this one morning. And the two of them were sitting across from me, shoulder to shoulder, eating eggs and sharing a Wall Street Journal, which they'd opened to the stock pages. So I'm watching them read, or I don't know if that's what they were doing. They were only a couple of feet away. Their eyes are moving up and down the stock charts, you know, and this is up, you know, those down an eighth, up a quarter things that, you know, encode in the paper. And I noticed they were having like a really wonderful time. They were sharing glances. They're widening their eyes, like, "Oh my God, look at this," kind of gestures. Because for them, reading the stock returns was kind of like reading Tolstoy. They saw stories. They saw comedy. They saw tragedy. They saw hits. They saw opportunities for their greedy selves. They saw all kinds of misses. Me, I look at a stock chart, and those numbers just stay numbers to me. As I watched the two of them, their eyes dancing, I thought to myself, why can't I do what they do? It's like I'm missing a paintbrush that they got, a paintbrush I've never had, a paintbrush that allows numbers to tell me stories. I remember in algebra when the teachers came in the beginning, so let's solve for x. That was their way of saying, we have a mystery here. X is the unknown. So I take my first algebra classes. And when they introduced this idea, x, I thought, this is okay. Like let x be, and they give you a thing to think, put in your head. Let X be the number of cherries you need in this bowl. I say, okay, I got cherries. I got a bowl. I can measure the cherries. I can put the cherries figuratively in the bowl. I can do the abracadabra, whatever they're asking, the measuring, the multiplying. I now know what I'm doing, so I'm into it. But weeks later in algebra class, the cherries disappear. Now the teacher walks in and says, okay, let's think of X as 1/2 Y. And to the left of me, to the right of me, Billy Theodore, Florence Kalischer, they were always on the other side. They think, okay, yes, half why, and not me. I have one half Y in my head. What is that? I have got no bowls. It has no cherries. It's just one half of a Y. That isn't a picture of anything. And if I can't see something, I get a little nervous down deep down. This is, I know, not everybody's problem. I am probably what they used to call a math retard, but nowadays they call you differently abled. I don't really want to be differently abled. I want to be able to talk to people, including smart people, people like you, you know, medium to smart, and to think with you. And yet I have to deal with this secret and somewhat embarrassing fact that without pictures, I literally go dumb, and I go dumb quite often. I married, for example, a woman from a very smart family. My wife had gotten nothing less than an 800, the top score on every single SAT in high school, every achievement test. She got A's, you know, throughout. Ridiculously high marks on her law boards. My brother-in-law was number two in his class at Harvard, and looked like it, sounds like it. My father-in-law spoke, and I'm not exaggerating, Russian, Polish, French, Yiddish, Hebrew, English, and a smattering of Arabic. He was a soil engineer, crazily capable. And when I go to his house for dinner, he would sometimes turn to me, and in the kindest possible way, and meaning no insult at all, say, "Robert, do you mind if the rest of us speak abstractly for a moment?" I'd say, "What? What do you speak? What?" He said, "Well, you know, I'm just going to turn to the kids here, and we're going to go a little faster." And I'd say, "You don't think that I can follow you when you talk amongst yourself? Please be my guest. Go ahead, do whatever you're going to do." And the three of them would exchange these sly little glances. And what I would hear next sounded not like English exactly, but more like The Sims, speaking Simish, you know that game? I had no idea at all. The blur of words went so fast, I had not a clue about what they were saying. And this happens to me not just at the dinner table. Frankly, it happens in classrooms throughout my university career. It also happens at work, on talk shows, on television, on panels at universities. I'm sitting there, I'm nodding at this and frowning at that, but really it's all pantomime, because inside there's these little periods where I'm totally clueless. I have no idea what anyone is talking about. And I'm looking desperately for a hook to pull me back inside so I can grab with my inner eye on some picture, image, or something that will steady me, something to see. But I'm trying to catch a keyword or an image, and if it takes a while, the longer I'm lost, frankly, the more scared I get. And it can get really scary. There was one afternoon I remember in particular. It was 54 years ago, that long ago. And yet I remember it like it happened like this morning. I was in a little office on West 86th Street in Manhattan about to take my final exam in chemistry, which had been rescheduled, so I had to take it in this office. It was the last science course I would take in high school. I wasn't great at chemistry. I was working at it. So I looked down at the first question, took out my pencil, saying, "Okay, here we go." And as I'm reading the words in the first question, I realized that I don't see anything. I go, uh-oh. And then the second one, nothing, not the third one. And for the next 3 hours, I found myself slipping into a panic of visual emptiness that was so deep, I felt so lost and so sweaty. I remember not just the fright of it, but the shame, because I had tried to understand chemistry. I wanted to know how molecules break and bond. But from the very start, on the very first day of class, my teacher, Mr. Owens was his name, couldn't, adamantly refused to talk in pictures. Just wouldn't do it. 15 minutes in, on the first day, he handed out a course outline that told us when we go to our lab, we're going to be measuring enormous quantities of atoms and molecules, because they're really little, these atoms, and the unit of measure we would be using would be called, and he wrote it out in capitals on the blackboard, mole, M-O-L-E, like the rodent that digs holes in the ground. So I'm thinking, odd choice, you know, it's not a teaspoon, it's not a cup, liter, gram, mole. So I was the kind of kid who would, you know, I'd raise my hand. "Yes," Mr. Owens says. I said, "Sir, yes, why the word mole? Where'd it come from?" So Mr. Owens puts down his chalk, and he sighs the same sigh my father-in-law does at the dinner table. And he didn't answer my question. He said, he gave me "that is the word, your name, Robert?" "Robert. That is the word, I think you should just learn it." And But see, that's what I was trying to do, learn it, by asking for a story so it would make sense to me. And I've wondered ever since why Mr. Owens wouldn't even make the gesture, like, oh, funny thing, no one's ever asked me that before, or I never thought about that myself, or whatever. But he didn't, and he wouldn't. And in my defense, I don't need, like, a full technicolor detailed explanation of something. I just need a hint, just an outline of a story. I can fill in. I can abstract. For example, I once took a look at some bulls that Pablo Picasso drew. What Picasso was just doing was he was de-abstracting. So in the middle line there, you see a very, very bully bull there, very articulated, and then it gets a little less. And then there's this one here, which is just the teeny head, the horns, a little sexual organ, and a shadow. That's pretty much it. And I can handle this. The one on top actually is a little bit weirder, since it seems to either be pooping, I'm not quite sure, and it's got a very very even sorted set of things up there. But I really, almost no bull is bull enough for me. But the point is, I can handle abstraction. I can go from rich detail to summary to outline, not hard. What is hard, actually, is what the two financial guys did, because they went the other way, which is they could turn data into pictures. There are people, and you sitting here may be among them, who can go to a graphic calculator or a mathematical equation or a stock chart, and you can find in the data things about the real world, reflections of the real world. You can literally turn your numbers into pictures. So here's a lovely example of that. At Radiolab, we have a regular contributor on our math side named Steve Strogatz, who teaches at Cornell, and we talked to him about mathy things. One time, he was telling us about a discovery he made back in high school in his math class, taught by Mr. DiCursio, he told us. That was his teacher. And it was a really cool story, so we asked Will Hoffman, one of our interns, to make a film about this in video. So you're going to see that. So Steve was in his class in high school with a piece of graph paper and a pencil. And now let me just show you what happened. Let's do the
Steve Strogatz, a mathematician who we sometimes have on the show. It all started with a pendulum.
That our teacher handed us a little toy pendulum that was retractable. And then the teacher gave us a stopwatch and said, I want you to time how long it takes for this pendulum to swing back and forth 10 times. Okay, so I do the experiment. 10 swings, click, I record how many seconds it took, and then I write that in my little freshman lab notebook. Well, then he says, now make the pendulum a little bit longer. Do it again. And it takes longer to make the 10 swings, and I write down the number. And I do this 5 or 6 times, and I'm dutifully plotting the results on graph paper, which is what the experiment was really supposed to teach us, how to use graph paper. But what it taught me was this spooky thing was happening, which is that the dots were falling on an arc, on a curve. This curve was a curve I had seen before because I had just learned about it in algebra class, and it's called a parabola. And this really gave me the creeps because it was as if this inanimate thing, this pendulum, knew algebra. How could this thing swinging back and forth know something about parabolas, or how could that be built in? And so it was in that moment that I suddenly understood what people mean when they say there's a law of nature.
And a parabola, Steve wrote, is the shape that water makes when it comes out of a drinking fountain, the droplet shape. And it's not just droplets. You see this curve all over the place. All over the place. It felt, Steve wrote, like I was being let in on a secret. There is beautiful pattern in the world, but patterns that come particularly alive when you know math. And these patterns exist, Steve thought, outside of nature. You find them in the math and then here in the world. So math first, nature second, or the math knows and the world shows. And when Will went around, everywhere he looked, there it was again. And this is a lovely thing to do, to look with a filtered eye for the shape you're seeking. And I keep saying hello.
We're going to take a quick break, and Robert will stay with us. We hope you do, too. He'll even show us some of his work as a TV reporter, where he makes a very creative metaphor about octopuses. Stay with us. Welcome back to our Radiolab-esque special on Maine Public Radio. It's an hour with Robert Krulwich at the Maine Science Festival. Now, here he is now.
I don't have the talent or the knack for numbers that those guys have. I've never done what Steve Strogatz did here or what Larry Tisch and his business friends did at breakfast reading the Wall Street Journal. The numbers that they can actually use numbers to conjure up patterns in the real world and discover things in the real world through logic, that they can go from numbers to real life. I can't do that. When I look around, I just see bats and bricks and cups and saucers. I don't see equations. The world doesn't seem like living math to me. It feels like stuff. I just see stuff. And so if I'm imagining a meadow, an ordinary meadow, I'm going to show you now an ordinary meadow. And so there's a stream and a bunny and a carrot and some ferns down there. Yet there are people I know, who, because I interview them all the time for Radiolab, who can turn these images into equations, or maybe like this, they can do it backwards. They can turn the equations into images and summon up from the math things like this scene. So this tree is respirating, so that's the math for the respiration. That bunny is expiring CO2 and eating the carrot. That's carrot stuff. That river is flowing. I guess that's flow stuff. That sun is cooking. That's cooking things. And I guess if I gave this to somebody and said, look, I'm going to just show you the cooking, said, what is that? He said, well, it has to be a star. I guess it must be the sun. And this has to be, and so forth, and they can just do the whole thing backwards. Math, to an amazing degree, reflects and even creates our world. Now, why is this? I don't think anybody really knows. It seems, says the science writer Ed Dolnick, that God is truly a mathematician. You stand on a beach, you look at the ocean on a wild day, birds soaring, wind blowing, water tumbling. It looks so chaotic. And yet there's pattern. There's always pattern. The same things happen over, reliably, constantly, universally. Rainbows, over and over, form the same arc. You never see a rainbow like a pretzel. Or when a duck lands in a pond, the ripples spread out as it looks, unless it's a windy day, perfect circles. When a duck quacks, the waves from their throats hits the hairs in our ears with a very clear and dependable pattern. Someone could record the pattern and know that that was a quack. It's amazing that the universe seems to have rules, and that sometimes we can discover those rules without even inspecting the world, that the rules pre-exist in logic and in math. Now, for people like me who fear math and logic, a meadow like this is scary. It makes me feel like Bambi in one of those Disney forests, surrounded by scary shapes, menacing and unknowable. I remember a particular Bambi moment in ninth grade when I met the Krebs cycle in biology. Let's look at that. Anyone remember the Krebs cycle? I remember it fondly, look at this. This basically is how a body turns a hamburger or a pickle or an onion into a little bit of energy for your cells. This is how we power our bodies. But you don't see any Big Mac in this thing here with little bits of energy? Not at all. What you see is a recipe from hell, which your biology teacher wants you to memorize for some reason. They actually ask you to remember Oh, God, I don't even want to look at it. Steps with all of them in chemical letter codes. And yes, of course, there are some people who will, in your class, who Florence Kalischer and the other one, who will immediately gobble this thing up. But for most of the world, from what I can tell things, if I walk into this chart, I'm never getting out. I don't want to go in there. There must be a better way to explore the world. And of course, there is. And this is where I go down on my knees and I say, thank you, Lord, for lifting me out of the dangerous and dark and scary forest of mathematics with the power and the glory of pictures, of metaphor, which is my true subject. Again, metaphor is my way not to be dumb. I'll just confess it. If I am blinded by Krebs cycles, if I go blank at equations, what I do is I find a smart person. I say, can you turn this into a picture for me? Can you tell me a story? Can you give me something to see? Because if they can, what a difference that makes. Because pictures give me my brain back. Now, what is a metaphor? Well, the dictionary says it's a figure of speech that isn't literally true, but helps interpret or explain an idea. So a metaphor isn't real. It's not like real life. That's why it's a metaphor. You see a thing, and it reminds you, or you imagine it as another thing. Sometimes, technically, it's not a metaphor. It's also a simile, or but a simile. But our brains do this so easily and so naturally and all the time. In fact, you know, you can't stop doing it once it starts. And the advantage of metaphor, well, for one thing, metaphor allows me to see an old thing in a new way. So it just opens my mind. It says, this is like that. Let's play with it a little bit and make it imaginatively different. So that makes metaphors a little bit like rhymes. You can use them over and over again. Metaphors are a little bit like Swiss Army knives. You can employ them to whatever use you need. And this is just as important. Instead of seeing something old in new ways, a metaphor can also have you see something new in an old way. So for example, if you go to your smartphone to make a telephone call, the phone in your hand is a skinny rectangle covered in glass. It looks like a space, you know, talks to a space satellite. It does not operate or even look like anything like the phone your parents use. But the icon, of course, is the old phone handset, extruded earpiece, mouthpiece that used to have a curly wire at the end. The phone you see only in the movies, but this is old, representing new, and it makes the new feel just a little bit safer and cozier and more familiar. Let's do email. Email's digital, no stamp, no paper, no postal worker, but the icon, an envelope. The thing you do is represented by the thing you aren't doing anymore. And this doubles when you look into the camera function. The icon shows a 20th century camera, but when you snap the picture, it plays an audio file of a shutter sound through the, although digital cameras don't have mechanical shutters. So this is a double. This is an audio and a visual metaphor. But it works, right? Because you know what you're doing and you're reminded of it, and it softens the change from then to now. If metaphors comfort, and they do, if they open our minds, and I think they do, they're also, and this is really important, they can be fun. And fun matters. It matters hugely. Because whenever I laugh at something, that means I'm not intimidated by the thing. I'm sharing the joke, and the laughter gives me a little superior position to the thing I'm laughing at. So when the illustrator Christopher Nyman takes a bunch of leaves and makes a T-shirt into a tree shirt, that's cool, which is why we sometimes try to make Radiolab into kind of a metaphor banquet. So just for example, one time we got interested in a scientist named Cynthia Kenyon, who studies longevity in animals. How long does an animal live? And her special animal is the worm, the roundworm. And by manipulating the genes of that worm, she was able to extend its lifespan. She could make this worm of hers live 80% longer than it would naturally. In the popular press, they said she'd created the Methuselah worm from the Bible character lived for 800 years. So we thought, let's talk to her, find out how she did this. So what I want to play to you is, this has never been on the radio, it's just the raw interview. It's unedited. It's exactly as it went down. And I want you to remember that Cynthia Kenyon, first of all, is a terrific teacher. She talks to reporters all the time. And she's very, very good at it. And she's going to tell us about the two genes that she manipulated, which are called, for reasons I have no idea why scientists choose the names they do, DAF2, D-A-F-2, and DAF16. No relation to the duck. I don't know what it is. So here's how the interview went. Just listen to it.
The DAF16 gene makes a protein called the DAF16 protein. And that protein binds to the DNA where other genes are, and it, it activates or deactivates a whole bunch of other genes in the DNA. Mm-hmm. So the way it works is that the hormone binds to the DAF2 receptor, and when that happens, DAF2 receptor kind of squashes the activity of DAF16. It turns it down. Okay, so DAF16 can't bind to its genes mm-hmm. in the DNA and make them more active. Okay, so when you come along with mutation or some
the problem
other way,
here,
and you inhibit the act.
This is just Jad's description. She has a noun problem. She's terrific at describing the verse. She talks about suppressing genes, blocking them, dialing them down, turning them down. Her verbs, binding, squashing, these are very vivid verbs. But the nouns, what do you do with DAF2 or DAF16? These words are blanks mentally. They don't make you see anything. So we took this interview, and Jed called it a little noun replacement therapy. We're going to give the genes just slightly more character. So here's now our revision of the very same interview.
So what exactly is this gene doing to make them live longer?
Well, maybe we should ask the question a different way, because the worms that lived longer, they didn't actually have this working gene.
Right. When we make a mutation in the DAF2 gene, we damage it. That actually causes it not to work as well. So that actually is kind of profound. That tells you right away that the worm has a gene in it that's shortening the worm's lifespan.
Which is why she calls it
the Grim Reaper gene.
The Grim Reaper gene.
It's the gene that makes you die.
If you're a worm.
Right. So, by damaging this gene, Cynthia and her team essentially are taking the Grim Reaper and knocking his knees out.
No, stop that! Ow.
Okay, so the question is, what exactly is the DAF2 doing to make the cell age more quickly?
Here's where the story gets a little weird.
Well, we found another gene whose name is also DAF, but it's a different DAF. It's called DAF16. And this is a gene whose normal function is to keep you young. It's like a fountain of youth gene.
Yeah!
So, wait, there was a Grim Reaper gene before.
Right.
And now there's a fountain of youth gene?
That's what she discovered. And inside the worms, these genes are struggling with each other. Here's how it works when a worm ages normally.
The DAF2 receptor...
DAF2.
...kind of squashes the activity of DAF16. It turns it down.
Silence!
And so the worm ages.
Okay. So when you come along and you inhibit the activity of the DAF2 receptor...
Ouch!
Now you liberate DAF16.
Yippee!
It's free. It springs into action. And it activates about 100 genes...
1, 2, 3...
...in the DNA.
Go!
These 100 genes each do a little tiny good thing for the cell. And altogether, it makes the cell live twice as long.
Now, first of all, you can't do this without getting permission from the scientist. So when we created the Grim Reaper gene and the little baby youth gene, we did it with her permission, which she was, by the way, happy to give us, because the real goal here, which she as a teacher certainly understands, and which she shared with us, is that we want to create characters exciting enough to help you imagine and therefore consider things that otherwise would be unfamiliar to you. And this works. The simplicity... Dealing with making something strange suddenly familiar, it works because a good metaphor gives you the familiar setting to help you explore the unfamiliar ideas. There's something very satisfying about seeing things that are just so beautifully alive from pictures. And not just for me, of course. Some of the smartest people who've ever lived, some of the greatest thoughts ever thought, start with a picture puzzle. So I see Newton under the apple tree, the apple falls, supposedly, and he thinks, oh, there's gravity, I guess, pulling the apple down. I get that. But then he looks up at the sky and he says, now how come the moon doesn't fall to Earth like the apple? Is the moon too far away? Does gravity lose force with distance? And all of a sudden, his mind is chasing a huge idea. Marie Curie, the two-time Nobel Prize winner, once said, a scientist is like a child gazing at the world, seeing things as though they were fairy tales. And that's how science and science reporting begin. Tell me a story, set my mind wandering. And it's thrilling sometimes to see a really sophisticated mind, a person infinitely more sophisticated than me, who knows his math, still choosing simple pictures to explain the world. James Watson, the co-discoverer of DNA, structure of DNA, got a letter from a physicist named George Gamow, Pascal was trying to figure out what code the DNA molecule has to pass the information along. And he has a letter which is in the British Library, and I want to show it to you. It's handwritten, and it happens to mention, of all things, the Krebs cycle. So, how we feed ourselves. Now, Gamow, by the way, is excellent at mathematics, pioneered Big Bang theory, alpha decay, quantum tunneling, radioactivity. He's writing this letter to a Nobel laureate in chemistry. So you'd think if two Nobelians get together to talk about anything, they're going to have a number on the page. What you would not expect is a bald guy with his mouth open facing a slab marked steak, and another one underneath. That was supposed to be celery in the middle, but Gamow couldn't quite figure out how to do celery, so he erased it and made it into an Idaho potato. So that's his Krebs cycle, discussed by two Nobel laureates. No equations, no algorithms. Hey, if they can do it this way, then we can do it this way. That's what I think. Metaphors are not just for slow people. They're handy-dandy tools for the brainiest and the least brainiest. Multi-purpose, as I said, available to all in a glorious way to explore the world. Though, of course, to be fair, metaphors have problems. We know that. They can inform, but they can also mislead. For one thing, you can only compare things to a world that you know of. So metaphors are dependent on familiarity. So suppose Sherlock Holmes was told, there's a man in London right now walking down Oxford Street who's talking to another man in New York City in Central Park, 3,450 miles away, right now in real time, talking in soft voices. I could hear Holmes thinking, well, that's impossible, my dear Watson, because what else could he think? A 19th century man cannot imagine a 21st century cell phone. Metaphors are limited by time. You can't compare something to a computer if you don't know what a computer is, which means there's a universe of future or forgotten possibilities that are missing whenever we metaphorize. And also, I think, a tendency to glamorize whatever the newest technology is. So when the Greeks were asked to explain why a heart works, they said, well, it's a furnace, obviously, because they were burning things. Later on, when they were pumping things, it became a pump. Same with the brain. As Ed Dolnick reminds us, at the end of the 19th century, the brain was described as electrical, a whir of flashes and light and connections. So that's a riff on Edison. Then it becomes a steam engine. The pressure of repressed memory and dark desire can lead to catastrophic explosion. That would be a riff on Freud. Then it's a switchboard, sort of a la Alexander Graham Bell, with plugs and cords. And then, of course, it's a computer with inputs and outputs and software. Scientists have this habit of imposing the latest technology onto nature itself, which couldn't care less, which means very often what we see in these metaphors is not truth, but just fashion. And there are bad metaphors. There are really bad metaphors, embarrassingly so. Remember, a metaphor is an approximation. This is like that. So when you're this, wanders a little too far from you're that, the metaphor can whack you back in the face. You know. So, and I had this experience once, which was really awful. One time, I got a videotape from a marine biologist. And when I looked at it, I thought, oh, my God. It shows an octopus in shallow Caribbean water doing something. Well, I'd never seen anything like this before. So I ran down to Peter Jennings' office at ABC News. Peter was the anchor and editor of the news in that company. I was working there. And I said to him, look, I have an octopus story that's going to just knock your socks off. He goes, no, I'm busy today. Wait, not today. I said, no, it is so good. I've got, no, he says, no. I'm going to stick it in your tape deck, and you've got, no. I said, why not? He said, it may have escaped your notice, Robert. The United States has just occupied Baghdad, and we've just conquered the place, and Saddam Hussein and his two sons have both disappeared, gone missing, and that's what we're concentrating on. I said, the whole show? You have 18 and a half minutes. You can spare 2 minutes for the octopus coverage. No. Come on, no. Okay. That's it. What if I make my octopus story about Saddam Hussein? Now he's looking at me. I just put all my eggs into the metaphor basket, just for the stupid purpose of getting on TV that night. And, oh, I'm really not too proud to show you what you're about to see. The longer it takes, the happier I am.
After Saddam and his son stole more than $1 billion, there's talk now that he is searching for a cosmetic surgeon to disguise himself. Well, Saddam the dictator might want to meet Saddam the octopus, because some octopuses really know how to disappear, says biologist Roger Hanlon.
This is what octopuses do for a living. They disappear all the time.
For example, Roger saw this bush in shallow Caribbean water, but as he moved closer, now watch the bush. Look at this.
I mean,
you know. It turns into an octopus.
So if they see the algae next to them, they can mimic the algae.
Yeah, it's definitely getting lumpier all over, and this is happening. The muscle changes and the color changes. How long in real time?
It takes less than a second to make any of these changes, so they can become a rock in less than a second. It's instantaneous.
Gone. The octopus and its cousin, the cuttlefish, this is a cuttlefish, are simply, says Roger, the planet's masters of disguise. Nobody, watch this cuttlefish, nobody does it better. So if plastic surgeons could figure out what the octopus does, certain people might pay considerable sums of money, especially for a quick change.
I think the octopus can change its appearance as quickly as any animal on Earth. If you could turn that into plastic surgery, it'd be pretty cool.
Indeed. Robert Krulwich, ABC News.
Don't applaud. That's not don't applaud. Absolutely, metaphors are a gamble. So, and when you lose badly. Oddly enough, sometimes even when you win, when you coin a gorgeous and vivid metaphor, still you can lose. One time I was talking to Richard Dawkins, who came up with the phrase selfish gene. It was the title of a book he wrote in 1976. And he was arguing, yes, evolution is about competition between organisms, but deep down, the real agents of evolution are these little chemicals, these genes deep in our cells. And genes really hadn't much captured the public's imagination until Dawkins called them selfish. And that one little word, selfish, gave them just the drama and the character they need. It wasn't the DAF 16 kind of overdone thing, but it was essentially the same thing, which gave people a way to see genes more vividly, which is a wonderful thing, except the imagery worked a bit too well. The selfish, of course, suggests that genes have purpose and intention, which they don't, and that they are, you know, they are our fate, and give us all these diseases, which is not true always. That genes are destiny, certainly not true. Genes aren't literally selfish. They're brainless chemicals. It was the metaphor that made it so powerful. And Dawkins had said to me, I've for 40 years now, had to spend too much time trying to talk down the phrase that made me famous. And yet, here's how I want to end this talk. I've told you metaphors are wonderful, and I've told you metaphors are trouble. But on balance, where would we be without them, without this way of translating the world for those of us who don't have numbers? If math is the way to truth, I guess we could all go home and go back to math class and bone up. But would I? I love the world. I love telling stories. But do I love it enough to go back to algebra class? No, sorry. But here's my consolation. This is my deep consolation. I think, or at least I've come to think in writing this talk, that metaphor might be the best way to understand the world, even better than math. And I say this humbly, not privy to the beauties of mathematics. But as I understand it, Einstein and Newton didn't invent the mathematical laws of the universe, they discovered them. E has always been equal to mc squared, before Einstein, during Einstein, after Einstein, always. The laws are out there, hiding in the universe, waiting to be found, and certain very clever people discover them. Metaphor, on the other hand, that's in us. It's a deeply human act to compare your lover to a summer's day, to say all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. That's a person talking, not logic, but heart. Metaphor has feeling and connection, and that's its power. It's a very human way to explain the world. And the good ones, the good metaphors, they don't just exclaim. They do it so intimately, using what we already know to tell us about the things we don't know. Like that water gurgling into those squares I showed you, they tell the story when they're really good. They tell it perfectly, intuitively, like mystery telling on itself. Here I am, the metaphor whispers. And you stand there and say, oh, yes, now I see. So let me end this talk with one final now I see. It comes from Lauren Isley, a not so famous anymore, but in his day, huge, remarkable scientist who wrote in the 1950s and 60s. And he's wondering how to explain, and forgive me because this doesn't seem like a big thing, how valleys and canyons get formed over time. Basically, he's trying to explain erosion, which is hard because things happen so slowly, it's tough to see at any moment with your eyes how erosion works. It's just so slow. So I imagine him standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon, trying to account, in some way, for this immense, gigantic hole in front of him. How did it get there? And the phrase he comes up with, and he says it just in passing in a sentence in one of his books, is, "We are looking at," and this is the quote, "the magnificent violence hidden in a raindrop." The magnificent violence hidden in a raindrop. Every raindrop falling, I don't know, up in the Colorado Rockies at the headlands of the Colorado River, suddenly becomes a teeny splash of a shovel pushing a grain of earth out of place, and then another, and a trillion billion raindrops pushing a trillion billion grains over a million years, digging and shoveling and pushing, and what do you get? You get a hole, a huge hole. And you know what? It is violent, it is magnificent, and the process is hidden. What the Grand Canyon is a reflection, yes, of the magnificent violence hidden in a raindrop. Can an equation do that? Can an algorithm do that? No. Only a mind like mine, a mind like yours, a human mind. And that's why I love metaphors, because they're so deeply fallible and sensual and beautiful and so deeply human, like me. Thank you.
We're going to take another 60-second break, and Maine Public CEO Mark Vogelzang will join Robert on stage for a Q&A session. Robert will talk about the secrets of his storytelling for Radiolab. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to our not quite Radiolab, but basically Radiolab special. Maine Public CEO Mark Vogelzang is going to talk with Robert Krulwich about the inner mechanisms of his reporting style.
Thank you. Let's give another round of applause.
These are like fun. This is like getting to give a speech is like a whole other thing. Like you can just do anything, and there's no way someone would say, well, let's talk endlessly about metaphors. That's no, you're not going to get an invitation like that unless you don't get it, and then you just do it to them, which is what I just did to the person.
But this crowd gets it.
Yeah, I know. No, it's really a pleasure. You're a really good audience. Like when you're performing something, you can feel the pressure of attention, and I just felt it. So.
And I think we were geeking out a little bit, and I'm speaking just for myself, but I'll extend it to the audience. I think we were geeking out on having an NPR rock star in our midst. We would like you to participate, and this is unrehearsed, but we are going to have you tweet questions for Robert, and I get to interpret them and read them to you, and you can answer them.
Okay.
How's that for a convoluted...
Yeah, I don't know why you need... Because microphone. Someone could just simply stand and give voice, but that would be so 1910. Yeah. No, I appreciate... I think that, of course, we should, whenever possible, do a modern technological thing.
So why don't we start with a couple of questions about your radio background.
Yes, I wanted people... I wake up most mornings not understanding things like most people. Mm-hmm. And then instead of thinking of myself as a problem to be solved, I think of the problem to be solved as... I figure there are many people who wake up quietly not knowing anything either. And so it's useful if the one not-knowers tell the other not-knowers what there is to know. So
and you start from the beginning is the Radiolab thing. Like you know, if we were going to do hockey, I say Radiolab, that you really have to say, this is a sport played on ice wearing special shoes with blades on them. Why blades? So you can glide. You know, and start all the way at the beginning as if everyone in the audience is a Martian. And there will be hockey people who say, come on! But there will be many, many silent more people who go, thank God, I never knew what those shoes were. That kind of thing. So that there's a faith in that one's private shame is actually everybody's private shame, yeah. And thereby lies a living.
And this sense of when we all discover that asking a question, which may seem dumb because you really don't understand it, there's often all other people in the room, in the classroom, who also have the same right. question as you do.
So it requires a certain boldness. I think an armadillo-like skin, probably. There's been occasions where I've been holding the microphone out in front of some know-it-all who is shocked and astonished that I don't know it, whatever it is. And there's something about when your hand is extended and you start getting nervous, the tremble becomes exaggerated when the microphone is left. So you have the microphone going like this in front of the, and so they know you're scared.
Yeah.
But you don't cry. You just stay there with the microphone and demand the answer. And not everybody can do that. Like that's yeah. If I have one talent, it's the willing to be stupid in public, I guess, and just stay there, because I think you. I'm somewhat ashamed to be in the dark, but I'm anxious to get in the light. And I just don't. I think so. So help me. Is that asking too much? And when you know, there are people who just like Mr. Owens from my chemistry class who just didn't want to help, which is funny since he was a teacher. But most of the time, and this is true of businessmen and scientists and generals. Generals are usually the hardest because they're in the middle of doing something that's life or deathy. As you ask them to tell you a secret, they can't. But you know, and they're just odd things. Like when the United States was invading Kuwait, so Peter said to me, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Well, I have a few questions." "Oh yeah, I'm sure you do." "Like what are they?" I said, "Well, it's a Sherman tank. You know, it gets only 1 mile per gallon." He goes, "What?" I said, "Yeah. So we're in a tank war. They're going to send all these tanks from Kuwait City into Iraq. But how will they get there? I mean, they'll all go like 1 mile, and that'll be the end of the invasion." So there's got to be some thing that gets them refilled. And by the way, when they're in battle and shooting at each other with missiles, going to be like, who's going to be the refueler? Who's going to come into a situation with a large bottle of petrol with missiles flying? I just need to know the answer to that. He goes, "I don't think anybody." I said, "Are you kidding me? Once I ask this question, everyone's going to want to know the answer. It's like if I were to go to you and say, 'Look, you see that cloud up there?
Yeah.
It's wet, right? It's a cloud. It's got moisture in it. You know water's heavy. You carried pails of water. You know it's heavy up there. I bet you there's 50 tons of water up there. It's a small cloud, but up at the fifth, why doesn't it fall down? Nobody knows. Nobody can see anything under the cloud." It's those questions, whether how do you go to the tank war on 1 mile, or how does the cloud stay up? Those, I think those are interesting, and they're not all that political, and they don't involve a tremendous amount of faith or red-blue issues. They're just simple, dumb questions. And you can go, you can walk with your stupid questions into very, you can go up to a general and say, "Look, I'm just curious, how does the tank," and he goes, "Well, everybody knows this, and nobody does except him, you know?" And you just have to, that's the part that you have to be brave. You have to be brave in announcing what you don't know.
Twitter has not failed us.
Oh, good.
So
I was vamping for you.
Matt Green writes, "How do you develop topics for Radiolab?"
Well, everybody comes up with things, and then we tell each other how stupid those things are. Then the same process I just described. So I'm fairly interested in plants and their secret lives, and he doesn't interest it at all. So I have to push the and he's very interested in investigative reporting about law lately, and I went to law school so I can help with that, but I'm not as interested in him. So we just, we it's like preparing a dish which the other person doesn't want to order. And then you have to make it tasty enough that you can get it to be edible. It's not the nicest way to do it, because there's a lot of yelling and stuff, or just hurt feelings and kind of sitting. Like I get really mopey when I don't win. But
But we all like each other, though.
You do that in the studio, too. There's
yes,
some of that. You talk over each other, which is a rule that you don't do in radio, to talk over, but you guys do it, and you interrupt each other.
Yes, there are, like, I one time, just for the fun of it, because you like, I was invited to East Berlin to talk to a group of radio ad salesmen who work mostly in Siberia. So essentially what they do is they sell, American music to people in Novosibirsk. I thought, why am I getting this invitation? So I leapt on a plane. I said, I got to meet whoever these people are. What? That's the weirdest invitation. So I get up and I'm playing them, I'm playing them an example of Radiolab. And there's like just rumble, rumble, rumble. And I stopped it. I said, like, how many people listening to this think, wait, this is a serious subject they're discussing. Why are they giggling? It's not right. Every hand. I said, why are they unwilling to let the other person finish the thought? Why do they call? It's rude. Isn't it rude? Yes. Why is there all that noise in this show? Like, can't that person just say it in a quiet room? There's all that noise. It's in the way. Stop it. Everyone, yes. I said, each one of those things that we're doing is done for a purpose. And if you want, I can explain to you why we chose to do it that way. But if you don't want, you can just thump and thump and thump and go, get out of the room. And they all like little bits. I said, okay, yeah, go tell us why. And then I just had them for a little while.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are reasons. But the main reason, basically, is that it's political, really. It's our belief that what reporters generally do in circumstances where you're in a newsroom with a short agenda and not a whole lot of time is you get on with as much authority as you can muster and you tell people what just happened and you tell them as if it were true. Mm-hmm. So you develop a voice that says this voice clearly has authority because it wouldn't be like this if it didn't know what it was talking about. And you you write in short, quick sentences in authoritative voices and active voice and so on. I said, what we decided to do was we decided to demonstrate what curiosity is like. And it stumbles, and it gets it wrong, and it mishears, and two people can hear the same thing and get two different lessons from it. There is arguing, there is comparing, and there is being wrong in order to be right. And we wondered whether we could create a journalistic forum which would allow people to see what it was like to go through the business of learning. You never see Walter Cronkite standing on television saying, tonight, well, I'm not sure it's tonight. It might have been yesterday. Can we have a check on that, please? Okay, I guess it is. Well, let me just go on anyway. I mean, we would never do that. So, but we do. And it's because we're telling you the truth about our process. And, you know, that is, you know, although now there are so many podcasts and everybody's doing it that way. So, like a few months ago, one of our reporters had to ask a very embarrassing question and stumbled, and it was a very long, and the guy said, I don't get your question, could you ask it again? And he wanted the whole thing in there. I said, you sure you don't want to clean it up? And he goes, no. And he said, I want people to see how embarrassed I was, and it will give authority to the question to hear me being so nervous. I said, okay. But then, 2 weeks later, he wrote into a script, stumble. I said, what does that mean? He says, I thought I'd do that again. I said, okay.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Yeah, so anything that works for a while gets codified, and then boom, so now I have to say to people, like, come on, don't do that. Like be clear as you can and be more careful. But it is not always good to be confused.
A favorite episode of Radiolab that you have?
I mean, mine?
Yeah, yours. That's a tweet. It's not my question.
It's hard to pick. I think there's one called The Bad Show that I really thought was kind of wonderful. And there's one called Colors, which we just reprised recently with further investigation. I liked a lot. Mm. And there's been some recent ones. There was one about suffrage, about women's suffrage that I love. And I like my plant ones, all of the plant ones. Yes. I like the ring. Yeah. I just did one recently about three experiments about plants, which you could not possibly figure out how the plants figured out how to do what they did, and even the scientists had no clue. And it was such a pregnant question, like, what if they don't have brains, and yet? And Jed introduces, like, oh, no, another one of these.
you said you were trained as a lawyer.
if you had not done radio as a profession, asks one of the questions, would you still be a lawyer? Would you have gone back to practicing law, or would you have stayed in law?
I may be one of those people who got to do the one thing he could do. I mean, I did very well in law school. I fell in love with my wife in law school. I got a job at a very fancy firm, and the guy who I was working with, whom I adored, said to me, I don't think you're the kind of person who's... this is a service business, Robert. Like, it doesn't... Lawyers don't stand in the room and just say things and everybody goes, ooh, hello. You know, that you have to, like, clean up after stupid people, really. And you walk into the rooms here, like, as if it's going to be... as if it's Las Vegas and you want them to hear your shtick, and that's not going to work over time. So you are mentally capable of this, but you are temperamentally a risky person. And I was really disappointed in myself. I loved him, and I walked away from that conversation. He said, I'll give you a job, but I'm going to give you a year where you can't take it. So your parents will know that you went to law school and you got this job, and I will give it to you, but I hope you don't take it. So you have a year of confinement from what will essentially be a death sentence to you. He said, I hope you take the year and surprise yourself and me. And what a gift.
Wow.
I mean, what an amazing thing to have. And once I got that gift, I said to myself, what can I do? And actually, that inspired the speech tonight, I think. I think when I was in law school, I would write all these cartoons all over the books because I couldn't keep the fact situations in my head very easily. And I did have this explaining things and a picture problem. And I suddenly realized that that would maybe be fun to do. But there was no job like that, like make up situations that explain things. There was no reporters doing it. So I had to do it all by myself. And it astonishes me that I've been able to stay employed for the whole time. It was touch and go occasionally, but what would I have done if I were not what I'm doing? I would have done something, but I think I must have been a remarkably wonderful giraffe in my previous life. Mm. If I were a Hindu, like, this is like a crazy reward. I have most of my life been able to wake up in the morning and ask myself interesting questions and answer them for money. That just comes. They say, here, have some money. And do that. And play with people like Oliver Sacks and people who more than... This is the other thing. I think the people who I've gotten to meet are not just my heroes. They're people that are, to me, like miracles. Somebody like, even if they're assholes, like some of them are, like James Watson, or even so, like their deep curiosity and their fight and their poetry and their astonishing ability to describe the world. I want to sit next to those people. Some people want to sit next to Michael Jordan, and some people want to sit next to Meryl Streep. And I want to sit next to somebody like that, somebody who just is wise. And it's amazing to me that I've been allowed to do it. So I can't think about being something other than I've been, because I'm too thankful to have been the thing that I was, in as is, will be. I cannot account for my good fortune, actually.
We are really thankful for being in the same room with you and sitting next to you and asking questions and hearing from you tonight. So okay, thank you so much for coming.
That's it for our special program. Radiolab will be back next week. Special thanks to Kate Dickerson, along with the whole Maine Science Festival team who made it possible, Radiolab's Robert Krolbisch for his inspiring words, and to you for joining us for this special Radiolab-inspired hour. You can find it again online at mainepublic.org. I'm Roddy Nickpour. You're listening to Maine Public Radio.